We just wanted to go back to the different groups on people talking about the challenges and opportunities. So maybe first we can start with the challenges, but then we can go to the opportunities and that transparency and respect do bring. So I don't know if there are any groups that had anything to share about challenges of being transparent. So I think Abhijit, you had an example, or is Sanjay, you want to?
Nilofer from our group had a question. I don't know if she's here. She said she would be.
She's just joining us again, Abhijit. Sorry.
Okay. So if she's not there, I'll just ask what she had asked. So she was like, how would, the principles of respect and transparency, how would one put those into place? If I'm a researcher working with things to do like poaching, and I'm asking people questions that I may not be comfortable asking with, or the one who is answering would not be comfortable answering.
I think that's a great question, and it relates similarly to our questions related to not being, our group also discussed about, you might have some goals even related to the Shangong to Stupa, wolves. And, you know, if people really dislike wolves in the area, how do you even start that discussion? So maybe I'll ask Ajay, he can maybe take examples from that example. How does one go into starting a conversation?
I have little experience specifically of this case, like of question, doing interviews and so on. But I think a good point to start at, Juliet and the others, please feel free to add. I think first is to speak to the people and or the person who are you are trying to interview, and get them to sort of see if get them to see what you are trying to do here. And have their consent. I think having consent is extremely essential before you even start posing those questions. So giving them a context of what you're trying to do and giving them the choice of whether they would like to participate in an exercise of that sort, speaking specifically of, let's say, interviews is important. And I can give you one little example, because I was just involved in one interview survey kind of a thing that we did. Now, interestingly, the questions were common because that survey was happening across 5 countries, and the questionnaire had to stay common. So we were talking about what were the conditions under which people would consider killing a snow leopard. Would it be based on pressure from the community, whether it would be based on pressure from the forest department, whether it would be based on pressure from the monastery and so on, or from the other religious institution. But soon enough, as we started doing those interviews, I and my colleague who were trying to conduct those, we realized that some of those questions are very discomforting to the community, because here was a community that believed in compassion towards beings. And the very first question was, response to that question was that, no, we will not kill it. But the subsequent questions went into proving how they would try and kill it. You know, would you think of doing it in this way or that way? So once we had posed those questions to a couple of the participants, we could sense the complete unhappiness about the questions, despite the fact that we had their consent and we had already let them know. And I think at that point, it was for us to realize that it wasn't a wise thing to do. And so we had to actually check our expectations and step back and be as sensitive as possible. But if we felt that the response to a certain question was of a certain kind, we wouldn't probe it very much further. It may have come at the cost of the research happening in the way we had designed it. But I think it was a minor compromise to make, given that we thought it was only fair for us to also be sensitive to that.
Juliet, do you want, I think, and Charu can maybe share more on that related to illegal activity and transparency, because I don't know, Charu, you might have an example from the field from Kyrgyzstan, for example, or other place you could share with us. You can start now talking, Charu. I know you don't have a video, but you have a mic, so we are grateful.
Yeah, thanks, Justine. I don't know if I have an example that I can remember clearly, but I think it's really also about respecting everyone's autonomy, right? I mean, that if somebody is not comfortable with either our views or our questions, then we just have to figure out, either not ask them or figure out ways of asking them that would make them comfortable, ways of, you know, creating that, you know, that environment, a safe environment for them where they feel that, you know, they can talk to you freely, they can answer your questions truthfully. And if that's not going to be possible, I think it's just that autonomy and their desire not to share information just needs to be respected. I do not know if there's anything else we can do about it, but that would be my personal view on it.
Thanks, Charu. Another question that we got, another challenge that people face, I think related again to transparency and respect, I think these two principles seem to kind of overlap in these challenges, is often it's difficult related to funding. So we might, there might be an expectation as we're coming from outside that we have a lot of money on and how much the program is worth versus salaries. Our salaries, we might be asked, or, you know, and things related to money. If the program involves a livelihood, a component, there might be a lot of questions about this and the funds. And this can be a challenge and how to balance that transparency and that respect. So I don't know if Charu, you want to comment on that again, or anyone else?
Sure, Justine, maybe I can say a bit and then others can chip in as well. And I think that's a great, great question. And it's sort of not just, it tells us much more, apart from putting us in an awkward position, it tells us also that when we ask people about their livelihoods, about their incomes, and then we have to be mindful that people might not be comfortable sharing this kind of information, right? And so again, you know, I think the main point is every context is going to be different, so I don't want to sound very prescriptive, but these are the kind of lessons we need to, the questions we need to ask ourselves and then the lessons we need to learn. If it makes us uncomfortable that somebody is asking us how much wealth we have or what our income is, then I think we have to be equally mindful when we want to do our socioeconomic surveys and really ask ourselves, are we asking the right kind of questions and are we asking them in the most appropriate manner? And when we talk about transparency, I think there's a couple of important aspects to it, and it's absolutely fine to sort of deflect or politely reject those kind of questions in my view, right? Because I would not be comfortable if somebody was asking me about my salary, as long as I'm also mindful that I give them that same kind of space and the same kind of respect. But really, I think the key things are here, it's about, when we talk about transparency in particular, it's about, you know, one of the most critical things is disclosure of purpose. Why are we doing what we are doing? Sometimes, you know, we tend to hide facts. Sometimes we tend to not tell our entire purpose, right? If there's been a case of maybe a suspected case of poaching or things like that, we suddenly decide to wear a different hat and start acting more as undercover agents or detectives or whatever. And that's really a non-starter when we're talking about community-based conservation. So if we are going to go and start exploring any such instances where, let's say, a snow leopard had been killed, for us to hide really who we are and, you know, just pretend that we are just some people passing by, just curious to know about what happened and things like that, I think those sort of are problematic. Those kind of approaches tend to be both non-transparent as well as they tend to be in some sense bordering on unethical. I think similarly, we are talking about hiding our weaknesses, you know, what, let's say, whether it's any kind of program that we are discussing with communities, And we downplay the weak points. We downplay the fact that things can go wrong, despite knowing that they could, right? And so so some of those things I think can, like for instance, this whole point about, you know, we started these village reserves with communities, maybe that has come up in the earlier discussions with people and with this group. And the idea was that, you know, there's intensive grazing in most of the habitats. And our idea was that if we could protect some of the key wild herbivore habitats from livestock grazing, the population of wild herbivores could increase, right? And then and most of our communities with whom we actually tried to set this up agreed, and we had those village reserves being run, several of them. But one of the things that we used to say, and at that point in time, truthfully, was that, look, you know, if wild ungulate populations increase, maybe the livestock predation would go down, because the predation pressure by snow leopards would get deflected, they would kill more wildlife, and, you know, less of livestock, simply because there is more wildlife. If we are able to protect the pastures for a few years. And while the first part turned out to be accurate, and which is that while the herbivore populations increased in some of our village reserves, the research showed that actually it led to more livestock depredation and not less livestock depredation, because there was more use of those areas by snow leopards, because it became like a sort of a hotspot of wild herbivore density. So then, you know, following from those learnings, it would be completely inappropriate for us to either use that argument that the predation pressure would get deflected and more livestock would become safer. Not just that, but I think it becomes our responsibility to let people know that, look, you know, it would be a good thing if wild herbivore populations increase. But of course, there is always this risk that predation by snow leopards may also increase. And therefore, you know, maybe we can do other things as well. Maybe we can secure the corrals collaboratively. Maybe we can start livestock insurance programs, have better herding practices, etc. So I think the coming back to the main question, I really think that those boundaries of transparency they are defined and in some sense really focused on, open communication about the program, open communication about our purpose, and open communication about the knowledge we have, and open communication about the strengths and weaknesses of our programs and how they could be strengthened. I think that's where the principle becomes more important. And as for the rest of it, how much funding your project has, you know, of course, if a local community is a partner, not just, when I say a partner, as in they were part of the project proposal, and there are aspects of the project that they are implementing, including budgets and so on. That's a different case. And of course, that's where we need to obviously share that all the information, accounts, and expenses transparently. But in most cases, you know, local community, they're not sort of involved in the project per se, or the project proposal per se, or its accounting and expenses, etc. There, I think it is fine to divert the conversation away from, okay, how much money you have, or, you know, how much money you earn, etc.
Thanks, Charu. Charu, there's one question from Iftikhar, who works in Kargil, and he's very curious to know he's wondering how to make local communities understand the importance of wildlife conservation successfully. And your experience of having done the same over so many years now. And I think where he's coming from is the fact that sometimes he feels that a lot of awareness creation and education can create a lot of myths around wildlife. Iftikhar, please feel free to clarify if you would like to add to that. But
thank you. So I have observed that lots of myths and misconceptions locally or culturally sometimes benefits wildlife conservation. So I have experienced that when we try to educate them more or aware them more about wildlife conservation, it may lead to a negative impact on such myths and misconceptions, which are in fact sometimes benefits the wildlife conservation approaches. Like, I will give you a small story. There's a myth in Kargil, like in among the local communities, that ibex possesses a spirit. Ibex possesses a natural spirit. If you harm an ibex, somehow it will have negative implication on your life or on your relationships within your household. So I believe that if we educate them more, so this kind of myths sometimes, like not lot of myths, but these kinds of myths can vanish from the culture. So how should we go far with education and awareness in this regard? And I would like to know more experience from Charu. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. I hope you got it.
Yeah, Istikhar, my somehow I have poor internet connection. So when you're talking about the example, I'll just repeat it quickly so to make sure that I got parts of it. So is it about the fact that if you hunt ibex, then bad things happen? Is that the or something else?
Yeah, it's okay. Related. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, it's related to something like that. Only like there are lots of stories, folklores and all that, like it's kind of a misconception only, myths only, but sometimes these types of myths benefits our approach, our wildlife, the main goal that we are working towards. Sometimes it benefits it, but if we over-educate them or over-aware them about wildlife conservation with our modern education and all that, this might have some negative impacts also. Like
right.
So what should be the boundary that we should go to? Yeah, that's I just want to know, and some of your experience in the field, that how to aware, like how to make people understand the importance of wildlife conservation, because it's very difficult to make them understand. So
I get that. Thank you, sir. I mean, there's a couple of things I'd like to say here. Again, these are not solutions or answers to the question, but I think just to stimulate and encourage us to think in different ways. One is that that's more in terms of a more fundamental approach, and I try not to view what we talk about, you know, in terms of this kind of information sharing. I try to view them not as us educating them. I think it's a process of learning together. Just like we learn about from their knowledge, their folklore and myths even. I mean, these are, some of these may not be scientifically holding ground, but these are important parts of culture, like you rightly say. And so it's such of a mutual learning is what I would describe it as. And I think there's a huge amount of value and it's still been underutilized in terms of using folklore and this kind of mythology and folklore in conservation. The reasons for which are many, and maybe, this is not, we don't have enough time to get into those, but I think it's a highly underutilized resource out there. It's a part of people's culture. It's a part of their heritage. And it's something to be celebrated and brought out. Of course, when, like you say, there are myths of both kinds, some that are beneficial towards conservation and others that may be completely, have negative consequences for conservation, like the potential medicinal value of something, or, you kill something and then it gives you strength or whatever that might be. But I think that the going back to the narrative and folklore kind of thing, it's definitely something to be recorded, And I think there is potential for it to be used positively for conservation. Even stories like, you know, if you kill the ibex, then bad things happen. I think personally, I would try to focus on the message rather than the story, like that this is what our ancestors said. For some reason, perhaps they wanted the ibex to thrive. And that's why they discouraged us from, hunting it. And that's why, you know, this belief that that bad things could happen or whatever. The point I'm trying to make is, I think that in such cases, it would be good to actually focus on the main potential sort of reasoning behind some of these stories rather than the stories themselves. And it's something that I think we will discuss further in when we discuss negotiation as a principle. But sometimes it helps to take the story or the focus away from the superficial to perhaps encouraging people to think out deeper about why something like this might have come up and how, and that and a positive message brought out from there, even though the story itself might be negative. I mean, that's just my view on it, Yeptikar, but really, I think the answer to the question must be found contextually, and you being out there in the field, knowing people, knowing the folklore, etc., you would be in the best position to figure out how best to approach this subject. But people, please feel free to add.
To draw on that, maybe you can explain more related to the principle respect, which draws very much close to this question Yeptikar is asking. I don't know if you have a few comments to share with us about this principle and how you see it. Juliet's always shared it with us and discussed it, but I thought maybe, and then we can, I think Ajay has a few other questions that might come after that.
Sure, Justine. I think in relation to respect, personally, I feel that, there are two or three key points that are important. One is just when we go in as conservationists, scientists, or whoever we are, I mean, there's always a power dynamic that plays out, right? We tend to be the privileged ones usually. Or we tend to feel that we are the privileged ones with more knowledge, and yes, absolutely greater knowledge. Sometimes we do tend sometimes have more knowledge, not always, but and that puts us in a position of power. And I think being mindful of that, being mindful of the fact that we are already in an influential position with the community is, I think, constantly reminding us ourselves, and the fact that people may relate to us keeping that power sort of dynamic in mind is an important one, because else we will not be able to, I've written also, respect is not just about, you know, being polite and greeting people and, you know, and being respectful on the surface of it, but I think it's really important to be able to understand where the other person's coming from, what the power dynamic is, where you stand, and to be mindful of not being able to even inadvertently exercising our power. Influence, for sure, we all have an agenda, we have a conservation agenda, we try to influence people, we try to influence their behavior, et cetera, and that's something we just have to accept. But let's be very mindful that we are not inappropriately using our power, or people are feeling coerced to cooperate with us, and because those will not lead to really great solutions and long-term partnerships. I think long-term partnerships will really be the ones that will last will be the ones which are relatively, in quotes, equal. And when I say equal partnership, that does not again mean that, oh, you put in half the money and we will put in half the money. That's not what it is about. Sometimes that is perhaps one of the ways in which we, partnerships become more equal. But when I say equal partnership, it is more about our community partners feeling the freedom to say no to us. I think that question was asked earlier about also questions. I think people should feel the freedom to not answer our questions They should feel the freedom that they have a platform to be able to criticize the programs or what we are doing, and that they would be heard. You know, it's not like, so some of those I think become important. I feel that's an important aspect of respect. Then the other important aspect is, you know, respecting the fundamental dignity of the of our partners and of the other person as just a human being and nothing else. Because again, you know, we tend to become sometimes a bit more less sensitive, let's say, or a bit more careless or a bit more aggressive if we know that the person we are talking to is in quotes a poacher, right? We know that the guy has already has hunted, let's say, or illegally hunted a snow leopard, and already in some ways the person has fallen in our in our view. I mean, somewhere lower down, how can that person do something like this? You know, so he's a criminal kind of thing. And so I think that's it's really, really important. I personally believe that we avoid falling into that trap, you know, that makes us feel superior and that we feel that the other person is inferior because they've killed a snow leopard or whatever, and that person is a criminal. Okay, and under the rule of law, it might be a crime, but we do not know, we do not understand the circumstances in which that has happened. And we sometimes do not have enough empathy to put ourselves in that position and ask ourselves, what would I have done if my family was threatened, if my livestock was threatened, etc.? Would I have perhaps responded in a similar way? So I think that, you know, that respecting that fundamental dignity of the other person as a, you know, as a fellow human being is really critical. And these things are not easy. Not easy for me, not easy for anyone. You have to just constantly keep reminding ourselves. And the one last thing I want to say about respect, which is important, I believe, is we have to understand and respect the fact that there may be, you know, like any other community, like any family, including our families or extended families, there will be divisions and frictions within. There'll be a lot of love, but there'll also be, you know, there may be social divisions, political divisions, you know, individual differences, etc. And in our experience, it's been really important that while it's good to be aware of what those societal divisions are, let's never use those to get our agenda, you know, as a push for our agenda. Okay, this person is not agreeing with me, but, you know, let me go and talk to that other person or that other group, because then they will agree. And then, so that tends to create greater divisions within the society. And ultimately, these things seem to come back to bite us in terms of the impact they have on the conservation efforts. So I think an important part of respect, the final thing I wanted to say here, is also respecting sort of divisions and discord within the communities.
Thank you, Charu. That was very insightful. And as Juliet said, I was mesmerized with those discussions. I want to just go back. I think Deepshika's group had a kind of more challenging question in their group related to these two principles. So maybe we can ask Deepshika to elaborate on this question.
Yeah, thanks, Ashni. So yeah, in our group, one of the questions which was asked regarding the salaries and the funding, but follow-up to that was that community also has a lot of lack of trust in the NGOs and the government, because it's situated in such a in the border of the country, and they don't usually trust the government there. So how can an NGO you know, portray themselves more to be more transparent, and even when there's constant lack of trust in the community? So yeah, I mean, like, no matter what we say, they might always think that we are not being transparent. So can you elaborate on that as well?
Sorry, Justine, was that directed at me?
Yes, it was, Charu. This is your session.
Oh, no. one thing, maybe I can start by requesting Ajay, in case you haven't done it already, by requesting Ajay to talk a little bit about the trust triangle.
Okay.
Ajay, would you like to do that? Or yeah.
Okay. So, so essentially, the trust triangle basically speaks about these three the three essentials for trust to be there. And Juliet, please help me here if I forget. The one is accountability. The second triangle aspect. Sure. Sure. Because. So essentially, the trust triangle is an idea that has come from Stephen Covey, and he talks about it in his book of Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And what essentially he's trying to mention in that is that there are three very essential components to building trust. And there you have it. Thanks, Juliet. So there's accountability, there's capability, and there is intent. And what he essentially says is that all of these three are essential conditions. So the lack of any one of these three can lead to a trust deficit. So if you have you have intent and ability, capability, but you don't have accountability, that would lead to a trust deficit. And likewise, if one of these three elements is sort of lacking in the way or in your broader approach to how you are executing your work, it would lead to a situation where the community or the group or the partner on the other side is likely to see a deficit of trust.
Thank you, Ajay. So just continuing on that, Vikshika, for instance, I think it's good to ask ourselves why. I think you did to some extent summarize why perhaps there is that lack of trust, right? And a lot of it might have to do with earlier experience, people's experiences with whether it's government agencies or somebody else who went there, made promises, etc. Right? Now in the case of, let's say, often that happens that we hear about this, especially in some of the relatively remote communities, not that remote, but relatively remote, that so many people have come and they've made promises and we never see them again, right? So I do not know, and the circumstances and situations would vary between places and et cetera, but I think sometimes people have the right intent. They go and have discussions, and their intent is good, in good faith, et cetera, but they may not have the capability to actually follow through on whatever they have discussed with the communities, or there might not be enough accountability. This is lack of accountability in case you talk about things with a group and then you never turn up again, or turn up after 5 years or whatever. And so I think it's really useful to be able to understand the history of why these things are happening. And I think one of the most important ways of building trust really is presence. The first principle, one of the first principles that we discussed earlier. And, this, how do you say, face to face, being there with people, understanding, developing empathy, just being, immersing oneself in the community. I think sometimes there will be you can do all the things that you want in the world and still nothing will happen or no positive outcomes will happen simply because of things that are outside of your control. But the things that are under our control, and I think a critical element is presence. Do we have the ability and the desire to actually go live with people for as long as they are welcoming of us or allowing us to be in those areas? To live there, to be able to be interacting with them on a daily basis, not just over discussions and meetings for conservation, et cetera, but on a day-to-day basis. Do we have the time and do we want to make the time and the And do we have the interest in just sitting with somebody in their apple orchard or in their crop field while they are working or herding their livestock, spending a few hours with them, just talking to them, understanding the challenges they face, asking them questions about their lives and life and lifestyle, sharing information about ours, you know, really building those relationships and friendships. I think there's nothing in my experience which is more valuable than those kind of striking those kind of relationships. The other things can follow, you know, and usually, I mean, these are people like you and I, and when you and if they can see who you really are, I see no reason why eventually there will not be trust. But we just have to ask ourselves, do we have the bandwidth to be able to do this? Look, community-based conservation is a long-term thing. It requires sustained effort, and you take a very, very long time before you start seeing results. I always caution the teams that if you are seeing quick results, if a community is agreeing immediately, one meeting and they want to do this, and yeah, they've said yes, I get worried, because that's not how things work. And in our experience, when things have moved too quickly, they haven't lasted very long. So it is necessarily a time-consuming thing, and it's not just about investing resources, but also emotional energies into those connections with communities. And that's when I think the trust building can really move forward. Again, my view, people's experiences would be different, but this is just to share what I believe in.
Thanks, Charu. And just being mindful of time, we're going to soon wrap up. I want to ask you any final thoughts on the principles, transparency and respect, and even like you were starting to do, drawing it back to presence and aptness. If you have any final things to add, Charu, and then Juliet will end the session for us.
No, I think this is a very, very rich discussion you guys have already had before I joined in. And so thanks for the very insightful questions. I think that the only thing, one last thing I would caution against is, I brought it up in the context of these power dynamics, etc. But always keep reminding ourselves that we are not we are not the giver. We are not the provider in this interaction. Because, we are the ones, I understand fully how much hard we work. We are the ones who are bringing in funding. We are the ones who we think are bringing in the solutions for people, etc. But that's really not the way of approaching this issue. I think the way, again, that's about respect, trying to understand that it's an equal partnership. It's their cooperation that we are seeking in conservation. And sometimes what we are asking them to do for conservation, or persuading them or encouraging them to do for conservation, is actually much, much harder than what we are able to do in terms of being able to raise resources and bring in whatever, whether it's more awareness, better corrals or whatever. So let's never fall into that trap of imagining ourselves as the giver and the community as a recipient. Then there is no respect, and then the partnerships will not be equal. I think I'll end with that.
Thanks, Charu. Julia, go.
thank you very much, Charu, and thank you very much, everyone, for all your input and feedback and everything today. I thought it was a really, really exciting session about some key principles, the transparency and respect. Just to quickly summarize them in a couple of minutes before we end. So we really emphasize the need to be open and transparent about our purpose, including not just the benefits, but also the weaknesses, the uncertainties, etc. Really trying to understand and continuously reflect on where we and the people that we work with stand, so that we can really understand the local context, including, and we've mentioned lots of different aspects today, which was all brilliant, including power dynamics, histories of the area, the ethics and the cultures that we're dealing with, etc. And this was very, very strongly linked, as Terry pointed out, with the principles of presence, but also very importantly of building those relationships up. Then in terms of respect, the key point is seeing communities as equal partners in conservation, and really this point again that Charu made, which is a really essential one, of long-term partnerships being based on equal partnerships. So a really key point there, and as part of that, respecting the fundamental dignity of these communities as partners in conservation. So what I loved about today already is that we're seeing all these interlinkages with the principles coming through even more. So we've seen presence and aptness being covered a lot today through our discussion of transparency and of respect. But we've also started touching on quite a number of other principles like empathy, which has come up, but also responsiveness, which we'll cover as well. So I think on this, I will end.